Ah, yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy, gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
The BBC Music Magazine.
So welcome once again to the BBC Music Magazine podcast, your one-stop shop for all things classical music, live, broadcast and recorded. I'm Oliver Condy, the magazine's editor. With me in the studio today are editorial assistant Freya Parr and deputy editor Jeremy Pound. Hello.
Hello.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.
So before we get started, do head out and buy the April issue out now with Alison Balsam on the cover. Better still, if you fancy subscribing with a special discount for our podcast listeners, you can now get 30% off every six issues, which takes the cost of just £25.15, which is a real bargain. And you can claim the offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. Right, well, it's time for music news, and I think it's time for me to go first. So here's a bit of a clue to what I'll be talking about. So that was an extract from Vivaldi's Winter from the Four Seasons on this recording performed by Iona Brown with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. And that was from our cover disc on the January issue. But what I'm referring to is the BBC's new tranche of 10 pieces that they've just announced. The new 10 pieces, which is a series of 10 pieces designed to encourage children to really explore classical music in all its wonderful glory. 10 pieces includes Vivaldi, but also wonderful pieces by Bassiewicz, Steve Reich, Villa-Lobos, Florence Price, Brahms, Gershwin, and they're all under the banner of trailblazers. So all of them did things differently with music. Things pushed music along. So I went recently to the launch at Broadcasting House at the BBC, and it was very exciting.
I've got to say I'm very impressed by the 10 pieces scheme and how they've kept it going now kind of into their next instalment. And it is really working. Only the other day, my son was telling me that his school, they begin every Monday morning with a piece from the 10 pieces and they play it and they have a nice big picture of the composer up with his dates. And so all the kids at my son's school know all about 10 pieces and about the composers they're in.
And they've got a really big... So Hans Zimmer's doing the commission this year. They always have one person doing a new piece for it, and he's doing this year's one. And that's a massive name to get involved. So should hopefully lead to more awareness of it.
Yes, and the BBC produces, as usual, very good teacher resources.
Yeah.
So schools can really get stuck in. And, you know, there are a lot of hard work will be done already for them. So there's no excuse.
And while I am kind of slightly flying the BBC flag here, as you'd expect us to, it has to be said that there's always one or two cynics when these things are first launched and people said, oh, will this last? And it really has had a lasting effect, this scheme. It's been brilliant.
Wonderful. So, Freya, I think we're leading on to more chat about Radio 3, in fact.
Yes, we're very BBC heavy this morning. So they've just announced a whole new raft of programmes and presenters. And they've actually got Jess Gillam on board, the saxophonist, who I believe is 20. So that's their youngest presenter yet. And she's doing a Saturday programme called This Classical Life, when she sort of talks to other young musicians about their experiences in the industry and pieces of music that have really like caught their attention. So that's really exciting. And then they've also kind of elaborated on the Classical Fix podcast and programme that Clemency Burton Hill's been doing. And they're now doing Opera Fix with Danielle Denise, because apparently they kind of explained why they went into that on Classical Fix podcast. And Clemency found that actually opera was one of the areas of music that most intimidated the guests. So they're kind of wanting to open that up even more. So that'll be interesting.
I think it's interesting that you know, when you're young, you might not think that Radio 3 is for you. And I think these new sort of tweaks to the programmes will sort of speak to new areas of the population, new sort of demographics that say, actually, well, this is presented by someone who's my age, who, you know, obviously listens to music that I listen to. And therefore, I feel I can tune in. I feel I can listen and take part.
Mm. And the guests that they've got for Classical Fix previously have been people that are really in the zeitgeist, kind of millennials, very familiar with them. And when you've kind of got that search function on podcasts, it's a really great way of getting people sneakily in the back door into classical music, because people will search for those individuals and then come across this. So, yes, lots of change.
It's also worth pointing out that kind of older people also like listening to young people presenting programmes as well. It's not just young programmes for younger people.
Yeah.
It's nice to have a change of tone for a change, just
definitely
from the middle-aged people the whole time.
Jeremy, you're going to be talking about the South Bank now. So off BBC, onto the South Bank.
Yes, but there is actually a bit of a theme running here, because it's all our new kind of coverage of the news this month has been all about bringing new people into classical music. And this is exactly what the South Bank's new Encounters scheme is planning to do. Now, this is quite an ingenious thing. What it is is that they are inviting people who've never been to a concert before to come to one of the concerts at the South Bank, and that is primarily the Royal Festival Hall, in the company of a leading musician. So they will actually get a personal guide from the likes of pianist Stephen Huff, violinist Nicola Benedetti, conductor Marion Alsop, tenor James Gilchrist, so a wide range of musicians. And they will actually individually accompany these first-timers into the concert hall and explain what's going on, because kind of say why this is happening, kind of what this piece of music is about. The idea is that first timer will then actually be encouraged to go and actually say to one of their friends to come along. And that friend will also be allowed in for free. And the idea is that they'll then spread out. You'll have this whole new generation of people enthusing about the subject and actually encouraging their friends to come along.
Yeah, I mean, we know what it's like to chat to all these musical celebrities and talk to them about music. And I think it should be very exciting. I remember sitting in front of Mark Anthony Turch. I think actually Mark Anthony is one of the people on the scheme. So I was sitting in front of him for his opera Anna Nicole at the Royal Opera House. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful being able to talk to him about the production and about the performance.
Yeah.
And so I think everyone's in for a treat.
Yeah, and it can be an intimidating place, a concert hall, if you're a complete newcomer. So great way to break down those boundaries.
And there's only so much you can do with programme notes in a programme, to be frank. So actually having that, as you said, that first-hand experience would be phenomenal.
Yeah, very exciting. And Richard Morrison talks about it as well in this issue. So that's really worth reading. So now let's move off news and onto this month's magazine.
This month's magazine.
So don't forget about our website, classical-music.com. You can read about all the latest goings on, thousands of reviews, lots of stuff. And we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and we have an iPad edition available on the App Store. So do go and check us out. Sign up to our newsletter. You can find details about how to come to our awards on the 10th of April. Always great fun at King's Place near King's Cross in London. So you get a chance to mingle with us and also some of the winners and hear performances and just generally have a wonderful time. So it's time to talk about the April issue. Jeremy, the big star of our cover, Alison Bolson. Why is she on the cover?
Right, well, Alison is on the cover because April this year is all about festivals. Now, every year we have a big festival guide in BBC Music magazine. But this year we're going one step further. We're actually talking about it at the front of the magazine. Alison Bolson is the newish artistic director of the Cheltenham Music Festival. She was in post last year, but she didn't actually do any programming last year because it had already been sorted before she started. So this is the first year that she's actually really seen her own festival programme being put in place. And I went along to meet her and she told me all about kind of the difficulties and the joys and the various things you have to juggle to be able to manage a festival. It was fascinating chatting to her.
Mm. And also Michael White, one of our writers, has written a wonderful sort of survey of festivals and also what it takes to put on a festival somewhere where there isn't usually music at any other time of the year. And, you know, the sort of the amount of volunteers and goodwill that you rely on to put these things together. I mean, we're very lucky. Hundreds of festivals and, you know, all of them with so much going on and so much talent.
Putting a festival together is an absolute art form, because people always turn up and think, oh, well, they've just got this concert and that concert and that concert. What they don't realise is how many balls you have to juggle to actually be able to get the artists, the venues, everything in the same place at the same time. And obviously things don't go right, they don't work out, and you start with this creative vision, but it might not always work out, as Ashley said. Then you have to compromise. That we have such amazing festivals each summer is just little sort of short of miraculous, really.
And of course, the best artistic directors will naturally integrate education and naturally integrate all the social stuff and little fringy events and talks without it looking forced. And those are that's the time when the magic happens, really.
And also achieve a sense of continuity and yet push forwards into new areas without kind of irritating their kind of diehard customers. It's an art.
So buy your tickets, get out and have a look at our April issue and mark in your diaries which festivals
62
to go to.
Pages about festivals in
there
total.
Are, which is remarkable. So Freya, what have you got for us this month?
Well, we are going to start off with listening to the winner of our greatest film theme poll that we did with radiotimes.com. So we'll listen to it and see if you can guess what it is. So that was obviously John Williams' theme to Star Wars, and that was the winner of our poll that we did with radiotimes.com when we tried to find out the greatest film theme of all time. So we basically opened it up to the public to vote from a list of 40 that were chosen, which were kind of represented from all throughout the ages of classic cinema and contemporary cinema. And yeah, I think we all kind of knew that John Williams would feature pretty prominently, but he was actually featured 6 times in the top 10. So clearly he's doing something very right. So actually in this issue, Michael Beek, our reviews editor and film buff, talks to Patrick Doyle, who's a film composer, and he composed Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Hamlet, Sense and Sensibility, a few other things. And kind of sort of unravels as to what makes an amazing film theme.
This is important. It's not soundtracks talking about here. It's actually themes. So, you know, there are lots of great soundtracks that have been written over the past few years, but actually very few that actually contain themes that we'd all go home and hum and really that are embedded in our brains, those earworms that are really difficult, so difficult to write. And John Williams has clearly got that incredible talent to craft a tune.
Star Wars is the sort of soundtrack to my youth as well. So, because when it first came out, I was at primary school. I remember we all wanted to go and see it. And the first time I tried to go to see it, it was sold out. So we had to come back into Oxford another time. And it's kind of sends a real frisson down my spine when I hear it.
It's hard as well because you've got to kind of make a theme that works within the context of the film, but also has a life outside. You think of something like Jaws. That's become kind of notorious beyond, like, I've never seen Jaws, but you can't not know that film theme.
Well, as Michael says, you know, kids singing it in the swimming pool to scare their friends. And, you know, the Raiders of the Lost Ark always, you know, when you're on an adventure somewhere, the Raiders of the Lost Ark theme always pops into your head. It's real sort of magic, isn't it?
We definitely sung Star Wars in the playground as 100%. We were kind of shooting up imaginary stormtroopers and things like that.
So from Star Wars themes to a rather sort of, a rather sadder story about instruments that get broken as they're being transported around the world. Of course, musicians have to take their instruments on airlines, and cellists normally have to book themselves seats these days, but some people have decided to risk it and put them even in hard cases. And John Evans tells the story of some particularly terrible occasions when instruments have arrived on the carousel smashed. The airline industry has still to wake up to the problem of taking instruments on board, because violins are slightly bigger than the suitcases they generally allow. But, you know, there has to be some sort of give and take, really. It must be really nerve-wracking to see your instrument disappear and then come back again on the carousel and wonder whether it's in the same shape as it was when you left it.
If you see it at all, that is, half the time, frankly.
Well, that's very true. It is very important, and we do give it a bit of advice in the feature. It's very important that you do get the right insurance, you look after your instrument, and you don't put it in the hold.
I guess the encouraging thing from the feature, though, is that at least airlines do very slowly but surely seem to be understanding the situation a little bit better. They're not quite as kind of gung-ho about it all as they used to be, and they actually realise that there is an issue there.
I think it depends on the airline, frankly.
Yeah, well,
that's true.
I think the problem is that while there may be a policy, the staff on the ground, who no doubt are rushed off their feet, having to organise everything, aren't necessarily on top of the policy. Mm. So you may, you know, argue all you want, but unless the person down on the ground says, yes, you can go on with your violin or your bassoon or whatever it is, then I think there's always going to be a bit of a standoff.
Well, there are some artists who completely boycott the whole thing entirely and choose to get trains or other means of transport. Because I guess if you have, I mean, I'm a flute player, so I'm jammy in that I can just pop it in my backpack. But if you're a double bass player, like, how are you ever going to work out a system and getting that from A
to B?
Well,
you borrow a double bass, don't you, when you're at the other end?
True.
And I think a lot of orchestras don't take double basses because they use double basses the other end. I mean, I play the organ. I mean, I can't imagine taking a pipe organ on a plane. But I think when you're that mid-size instrument, like the bassoon or the trombone or you know, I mean, the story, no plot spoilers here, but the historical instrument damaged, there's the story of that in our feature. Mm. And that's a big instrument, you know, maybe small enough to book into the hold and risk it. I don't know. So that's called Broken Chords, and it's a story in the April issue written by John Evans. So, as the jingle said, it's time for First Listen. This is our chance to bring a disc that we've discovered recently to the table and talk about it. So, well, Jeremy, what have you brought?
Well, I've bought a new disc called Western Moods, which is by Ensemble Esperanza, who are a very young pan-global chamber orchestra. They were founded at the International Academy of Music in Liechtenstein in 2015, and they kind of get together occasionally, coming from all over the globe. They're all aged between about 18 and 25, so they're, you know, really young. And they've done two discs already so far. One's called Nordic Suites. The next one was called Southern Tunes. Now we've got Western Moods, so you can see where we're going here with this.
So what label are we on?
It's on ARS production, and the music on it is largely American, though there's little bits of British influence here and there. And it kind of goes from Victor Herbert, who was in his prime at the end of the 19th century, through to modern takes on the likes of Jimi Hendrix, Rolling Stones, and then there's the likes of Barber and people like that in between. Now, it's beautifully played. It's largely string ensemble stuff. There's occasional moments with saxophone in there as well. But the one piece which really stood out for me, which I'd never heard before, was Alan Hovhaness's Memory of an Artist. It was written in 1958, and there's very few recordings of it around. The artist in question was Sarah Berman, who was a Ukraine-born painter who was heavily involved in the US rights movement, and she died in 1957. Now, I want to play the third movement of this, or the beginning of the third movement, which I think is very beautiful.
Oh, that's very beautiful.
Lovely stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed that very much. So can we see Ensemble Esperanza in this country anytime soon? Are they appearing at all?
Their website doesn't give any details of any future performances. I think you just have to keep an eye on when they... I think they meet when they meet, and then that's it, and you have to just keep an eye on it.
Well, it sounds a very broadcastable disc, actually. Yeah. Sounds the kind of thing that we'll hear on our radios very soon. I'm going to take us into a new recording, actually, on the Soli Deo Gloria album, which is... the Monteverdi Choir and John Elliott Gardiner's outfit. And this is a very personal project. This is John Elliott Gardiner's Love Is Come Again, and it's a collection of music that was originally used to accompany an Easter play at his mother's local church, which he used to stage every year. You know, back in the 60s, John Elliott would come down from Cambridge and go to the local church and help out. And it sort of reminds me of sort of the Archer's Ambridge Christmas panto, you know, the time when all the village comes together, the local farmer, the friends, family, and sort of perform music and, I suppose, to celebrate Easter, Passion Tide. And what John Elliott Gardiner and Monteverdi Choir has done is recreate this music, to recreate the programme. Anyway, there's a beautiful performance of Thomas Morley's Ehu, They Have Taken Jesus. It's the words that Mary Magdalene says at the tomb in response to the angels, Why are you weeping? And I love it, and it's just very intimate and beautifully performed. So that was sung in English, a translation by John Elliott Gardiner from the original Latin, except, as Jeremy pointed out, the Ehu, which was originally Latin anyway, which means alas. Anyway, Freya, let's move on to your recording.
So I have brought Jeremy Denk, the pianist. He has done a new album with Nonesuch Records, and it's called Circa 1300 to Circa 2000, which doesn't sound quite as good when you say it as when you say it. So he came up with this idea. It's a compilation disc, basically, and he came up with the idea after the Lincoln Center asked him to come up with an unusual recital program, whatever that might mean. So he basically tries to sweep through kind of classical music history, going right through from Renaissance to current day, basically, and medieval actually is even in there. And it's just, it's really incredible how he kind of, it's not in time order necessarily, but it's sort of, you get a real journey throughout. And his playing is obviously stunning. And he plays the much older works with a kind of modern inflection, but not too much that it's sort of a bit twee and tongue in cheek. So we're actually going to listen to the final track of the album by French composer Binchois from the 15th century. So they sort of do a turn right at the end and go back to the sort of beginning of musical history. And yeah, it's kind of weird to listen to a track in isolation from this disc because it kind of, the effect is the overall thing. So yes, we're going to listen to the last track anyway. So that was Binchois' Triste Plaisir from Jeremy Denk's album Circa 1300, Circa 2000.
So the pleasure of sadness.
Yes, we've happy, all been very melancholy
sad.
This
we
month.
We have been, haven't we? I wish more pianists, more instrumentalists would sort of use modern instruments and explore ancient music. It's not an original idea is a bit of a shame because, you know, some of that music sounds gorgeous on the modern piano.
It does. It just completely makes it a different piece of music when you listen to other recordings of it.
Yeah. So down with Beethoven, up with Binchois.
Exactly.
So I think that brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Join us again for another episode. It'll be the May issue we'll be talking about. So it's goodbye from all of us.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.